This is the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel.
And I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. One of our reporters gets a ride into Libya with an aid convoy. She updates us on what's happening in Benghazi.
And in southeast Turkey, young children have routinely been put in jail, sometimes for years, for throwing rocks at police.
When my son came out of jail, he was not the same son. He never talked. He just wanted to be alone. His soul was gone.
And in Egypt, new freedom and new music.
This is my country and your country, my money and your money. So we both have to revolt against the slavery of you and I.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel.
And I'm Rachel Louise Snyder, sitting in for Peggy Waymire. The situation in Libya remains volatile. Forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi are battling pro-democracy protesters who want him out of power. The World Vision reports Bonnie Allen is in Benghazi, in eastern Libya, the stronghold of the opposition. Bonnie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Can you tell us, Bonnie, what the general conditions are like in Benghazi from what you've seen?
Well, driving through the eastern region and then, you know, walking the streets of Benghazi, I think what's most striking is how orderly everything is working, you know, despite the fact there's no police and Gaddafi's government officials have fled the region. In their absence, ordinary citizens have stepped in to do the jobs. They're directing traffic, sweeping streets, and you know, working together to distribute food and medication. So people are taking a lot of initiative, and it's a bit surprising because people here have lived under an oppressive regime for four decades in which personal initiative was not encouraged. But I wouldn't say it's business as usual, because there's a recruitment drive here in Benghazi to get young men to join the rebel forces, to give them military training. And there's also a lot of fear. I've been told by so many people that have heard Gaddafi say he'll fight to the death, and they believe that as long as he's alive and has military resources, that he will use them if he has the chance. And as one young man told me, there will be more blood before this is over.
Why are people so opposed to Gaddafi in the eastern part of the country?
People here tell me that they have been not only, you know, repressed, but that they've been punished by him because in the past they have opposed him. And so although this is an oil-rich country, they feel they haven't benefited from it at all. As I drove through Benghazi with some young men, they were pointing out so many examples, you know, buildings that are in rubble, a mall that's been under construction for 25 years, potholes in the road. So, you know, people believe they haven't benefited from the natural resources, either through infrastructure, through jobs, through education, or any opportunities.
Bonnie, you also recently spent time in Cairo. I wonder if you could compare the attitudes or the atmosphere between Cairo and what you're seeing now in Benghazi.
Yeah, definitely. As I was leaving Egypt, what was incredible was the number of debates and discussions that were happening on the street with people talking about what is democracy, what will be the political parties, what will be in the constitution. So it seemed as though Egypt was debating its future and what the political system would look like. You know, here in Benghazi, it's too soon for that. Because civil society is not something that has existed in this region. And as one man told me, we don't even have politicians. They believe that, you know, Gaddafi and his family have ruled this country and have kept all the power. So it's not even as though youth movements or political parties have any kind of membership or strength. So it's just a debate that hasn't been had.
We know that hundreds of thousands of foreign laborers are fleeing the country on a daily basis. What about people from sub-Saharan Africa? Do they have a kind of special vulnerability?
They do. As I crossed over from Egypt into Libya, what I witnessed was basically a chain of buses filled to the rim with black Africans. And as I stopped at several points along the way and spoke to some of these passengers, some from Niger, Chad, Mali, they explained to me that they were being targeted, or at least were afraid that they would be targeted, because Gaddafi is known to have hired mercenaries to fight on his behalf, including those from Niger and Chad. So the fact that they are black Africans makes them more vulnerable because they're more visible. And so many of them were fleeing the country through to Egypt, some with very little money in their pocket and no resources. You know, some of them were legitimately working in Libya. Others were illegal workers, but they're trying to get out of fear.
We've also heard about people from Egypt mounting massive aid convoys to help the Libyans. And I just wonder if you know what's motivating the Egyptians to help when they themselves have so many challenges ahead of them.
I had the opportunity to be at one of the spots where people were dropping off either money or bags of rice or boxes of medication, and spoke to some who told me that it's part of the spirit of the revolution because they are all brothers and sisters. They have to support each other in this movement and that they need to do anything they can. And as one Egyptian man pointed out to me, they've had their protests, they've removed their leader, Mubarak, and now it's time for them to help their neighbors do the same.
Bonnie Allen joined us from Benghazi. Thank you, Bonnie.
You're welcome.
We'll hear more from Bonnie a little later in the show.
Like millions around the world, Rachel, we've been watching this wave of protests that has swept across North Africa and the Middle East, and we've been wondering whether this tide would reach sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, it hasn't happened yet.
No, it hasn't, but there have been some stirrings, and there's been a call for demonstrations in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, Zimbabwe, and I suspect Zimbabweans aren't the only ones who are craving change. I mean, Africa certainly has its fair share of autocratic rulers, right?
It does.
So what does it mean that so far Sub-Saharan Africa has mostly stayed out of the fray? Do you think it's going to stay that way?
Well, Yon Nyako has been watching the situation closely. He's a professor of economics at NYU. He's from Ghana originally. And when I spoke to him, he said there are some countries that are ripe for rebellion.
Number one, of course, is Sudan. The reason is that Sudan is, in some sense, the closest among the sub-Saharan African countries to the Arab nation.
But isn't Sudan very focused right now on the referendum that they've just had to separate the south from the north?
You never know with these things. I mean, none of us ever thought after Tunisia that Egypt will go down and go down so quickly. But the situation is ripe in Sudan for something to happen. I mean, the leader has been there for a long time. I think many Sudanese are a little bit worried and upset that their country now has to be divided into two. There have been the beginnings of riots and protests, especially in the universities. So, yes, it could happen there.
Well, I'm guessing that another country that is very ripe for some sort of protest movement is Zimbabwe. And we know that people were arrested just for watching videotaped news of Egypt and Libya. Do you have a sense of what might happen in Mugabe, Zimbabwe?
Yeah, so all of us, of course, want the situation in Zimbabwe to be resolved as soon as possible. It would be great if Robert Mugabe could be eased out of Zimbabwe. But I just think the place is a whole lot more complicated than sometimes, you know, we read from the West. Don't forget that despite all the brutality, despite the several thousand percent inflation rate, there is a body of people in Zimbabwe who still support Mugabe. And the second thing is, most people know that Mugabe is an extremely ruthless leader. And so the cost of any kind of movement is very, very high. And so that's what is sort of lowering the probabilities, if you will.
You know, the one thing I've been wondering is, obviously, you know, there's this domino effect across North Africa and the Middle East, but there's a significant break, cultural break, geographical break, even between North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. Do you think that in itself could stop this fire of reform from spreading south?
It's not necessarily the geography that's different. Although, of course, you know, they're in the north and the rest are in the south. But it's just the many African countries are intrinsically different. different issues, different politics, different kinds of dictators, different kinds of military forces, okay?
But I'm guessing that there's certain things, I mean, we've seen some of the things that Tunisia and Egypt and Libya have in common, maybe not Libya so much, but that they have in common is unemployment, underemployment, combined with repressive regimes. There's plenty of that across Africa, as far as I'm aware.
Yes. So all those issues are important. And most important, of course, is that in those countries where their leaders who have been around for a long time, yes, many people get their inspiration from North Africa. The point is just that it's not as close, the affinity, the situations are not as similar as you'd have among the North African countries.
Well, we know this stuff is really difficult to predict. I think, you know, a few weeks ago, nobody would have thought that Libya would rise up the way it has and sustain the revolt as long as it has. But if you were to place a bet, is there one country in sub-Saharan Africa that you're looking at closely to see whether this reform movement might take hold?
All of this is complete guesswork here, okay? But we're looking at Gabon.
Can you tell me why you're looking at Gabon? What is it about that country that makes you think something might happen there?
Gabon is a place which has been ruled for a long time by President Omar Bongo, I believe something like since 1967. He died about a year ago, and his son took over. Okay, so you know that family has been in power for some 40 years now. It's a fairly affluent country, and yet many people are agitating, many people are worried that the oil wealth that they have hasn't been spread around enough. And so despite that oil wealth, many of the issues that led to the revolts in North Africa, unemployment, corruption, all those factors, all those issues exist in Gabon today.
I see. Is the situation similar to that in Equatorial Guinea? Isn't that, I think Equatorial Guinea is a very wealthy country.
That's right. Equatorial Guinea is in some sense even wealthier, and similar situation is going on over there. The leader there has been in power for a long time. There are four countries along that belt: Cameroon, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, and then Congo. Okay, four countries, fairly wealthy in terms of oil, each with a leader that has been in power for quite a bit of time. And so it's these are countries we are all a little bit, you know, sort of watching. But again, for the reasons that I mentioned earlier on, peculiarities of the place, lack of urbanization, historical issues, we may not eventually see anything happening there. But everybody is watching. They're the beginnings of revolts in each of those countries. We're picking up news on that as well.
Yao Nyako, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much too, Beverly.
Yao Nyako is a professor of economics at NYU and co-director of the Development Research Institute there. That's the sound of Egyptian musician Mohamed Zinati. He's reveling in his new freedom.
I think I am free completely. I can write what I mean. I think now I can fly if I want.
You can hear more music from Egypt still to come on the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder.
And I'm Beverly Abel. When the massive pro-democracy protests in Cairo began in late January, restaurants and stores around the city center closed their doors. Tahrir Square was full of thousands of people, day after day, for 18 days. They were sleeping there, praying there, and eating there.
Yes, because even in a revolution, people have got to eat, right?
That's right. So lucky for them, Abu Tariq's restaurant stayed open. And throughout the protests, the restaurant served up the popular Egyptian dish called kashari. It was all takeout. And what that meant was that these little plastic kashari containers littered Tahrir Square for ages.
So kashari literally fueled the revolution?
It did. Reporter Asia Bundawi was there, and she went to Abu Tariq's to see kashari being made.
Abu Tariq's restaurant sits just down the street from Tahrir Square, ground zero for the protests that have swept through the Arab world. and there's only one item on the menu, kushari. In Egypt, kushari is dubbed ekel shabiya, the food of the people. Layers of pasta, rice, and lentils are topped off with fried onions and tomato sauce, and a heaping plate of it goes for about $1 in Cairo. Abu Tariq is always bustling, and Cairenes young and old won't hesitate to tell you that the best kushari in town is served here.
There are foreigners and Arabs and all types of people who come here to eat. Most of the people of Cairo eat kushari here as opposed to other restaurants.
This is Ahmed Arabi, one of several chefs at the restaurant today.
As far as our restaurant goes, everything is unique in terms of cleanliness and the ingredients and everything else.
Back in 1950, Abu Tariq's restaurant started out as a simple food stand. Today, it's a busy three-story restaurant. Ahmed Arabi has been making kushari here for nearly 25 years. He takes me into his kitchen to show me how Egypt's most beloved dish is prepared.
See, first we have rice, lentils, and a thin spaghetti-shaped pasta. And here we have macaroni and some more lentils. And here are some fried onions. And then we add some chickpeas, and for kushari, the last thing is the tomato sauce.
You cook each piece before?
Everything is cooked separately. The rice and pasta and lentils are all cooked separately. And the macaroni is cooked by itself. So are the chickpeas. And the tomato salsa, as you see, is cooked by itself and is put on top.
And what's in the salsa?
Lots of spices. Bay leaf, cardamom, cumin, and coriander, and a number of other spices. Like I was telling you, the taste of our kushari here is distinct from others.
Chef Haman scoops a spoonful of steaming rice into a bowl. He quickly layers on a spoonful of pasta, lentils, and fried onions, and tops it all off with tomato salsa. Then he slides the bowl over onto a long counter. Waiters pile the bowls onto trays and serve the dishes while they're hot. Yaqeen Fuad has been eating kushari at Abu Tariq's for years. He prefers to get each component of the dish separately and then add the layers on himself.
I put the onions first, and then probably some hummus, and then the tomato sauce, and then finally I put the hot sauce. Yeah. Here we are. I like it hot. Then wheat. It's tasty.
How does it taste?
It's amazing.
Is it true that Abu Tariq's is the best kushari in Cairo?
It is.
Enjoy.
Thanks.
Since the massive protests in Tahrir Square have come to an end, there's no doubt Abu Tariq's restaurant will be seeing less carryout and more of its devoted customers choosing to linger in the dining room over a steaming bowl of revolutionary kushari. For the World Vision Report, I'm Asya Bundawi in Cairo, Egypt.
During the turmoil of the last few weeks, Turkey's been held up as a model of a Muslim democracy. But Turkey's got problems of its own. Just this week, Kurdish guerrillas called off a six-month ceasefire in their long battle for political autonomy. Hundreds of Kurds, including many children, were jailed under Turkey's brutal anti-terror law. They were accused of supporting the banned Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK. The anti-terror law was changed last summer because of international pressure, and many of the children have been released. But life after prison can be equally brutal for these kids. Dorian Jones reports.
For social worker Nevim Yakut Gunay, the doorbell invariably signals the arrival of another teenager released from jail. In recent years, Turkey's anti-terror law saw Kurdish teens not only being tried as adults, but also incarcerated alongside hardened criminals. These are the so-called stone-throwing children, minors convicted of throwing stones at police during illegal PKK demonstrations. The punishment under the old law, 8 to 20 years in prison. These children literally grew up in jail, experiencing things no child should ever have to experience. Nevim says many of them are suffering badly from the emotional toll of their incarceration. Often the hardest step for them, she says, is to ring the treatment center's doorbell and ask for help.
A lot of them say, I was in prison, but that's over now, and I can get on with my life. There is this denial. They say, I don't need any help. But in most cases, you can see from their faces that they've suffered a terrible trauma. So I start by asking simple questions. How do you sleep? And they usually say, I sleep 1 or 2 hours because of recurring nightmares, for example, that I'm back in prison. Then they talk about losing their hair and stuttering. Slowly, slowly their story comes out.
Nevim worked at the Human Rights Foundation Center, which is housed in a converted residential apartment. There's a kitchen and living room. The bedrooms have been turned into interview rooms. It's comfortable and homey by design to help those visiting feel at ease. Nevim says the children are encouraged to treat it as their own home. Simple things like letting them use the kitchen to make a cup of tea. The center helps anyone who has suffered abuse or torture, but now much of its efforts and resources are devoted to children. 18-year-old Hebon Akaya sought help here, and like most, he was referred to a psychiatrist. After several months of therapy, Hebon says he's now taking a break from that to concentrate on his schoolwork. It's a decision, he says, that his doctor does not condone. He still drops by the center, which he describes as a kind of refuge, a safe haven to process the horrors he has experienced. It started at the age of 15, when he was arrested with a couple of friends near a Kurdish rights demonstration.
I couldn't understand what was happening to me. When we were taken to the police station, all the children were lined up. And there were huge policemen, maybe over 200 pounds, and we were all so small. And they beat us up really badly. I just kept thinking, why? I just couldn't make sense of it. That memory never leaves me. Afterwards, when I closed my eyes, I was back there. I couldn't sleep. And I was filled with such terrible anger and feelings of revenge. But through therapy, I've started to understand that I need help. And I have begun to confront these feelings.
Hebon was charged with supporting terrorism and imprisoned for over a year. He appears calm, but his hands shake while we talk. Nevim Gunay says this is a common symptom of imprisoned children. Also common in a case like Hebom's is a ripple effect among other members of the family. Hebom's father, Arif, says their whole family was devastated by what happened.
We knew very well what prison meant. Because I've been imprisoned, my daughter has been taken into custody, my eldest son too. But we were so worried for Hebon because he was a child. I felt so helpless. And when my son came out of jail, he was not the same son. He never talked. He just wanted to be alone. His soul was gone. I remember thinking, should I take a gun up to the mountains and take revenge against the state?
But Arif found a different way of directing his anger. He joined other parents and set up a network called Justice for Children. The group is now working with this center and others like it across the region to help rehabilitate children like Hebon. At a group meeting, parents, social workers and doctors come together to discuss ways of helping the children. The head of the center, Necdet İpeküz, says they need all the support they can get.
We're trying to build a network of people, professionals, parents, and other NGOs. This has to be a collective effort, but we're desperately short on social workers and psychiatrists who speak Kurdish and understand the particular customs, cultures, and traditions of Kurds. That's so important in working with these children. This is a huge job, and all of the family can be affected.
Hebon, who lingers at the center during the meeting, will likely be one of his success stories. He's beginning to plan for the future and says he hopes to attend university in the near term. He's lost his youth to prison, but he's ready to move on as an adult.
After going through all of this, no child can remain a child. Before I was happy-go-lucky, but not anymore. The terrible things that happened to me and what I saw in prison ended my childhood. Yes, I'm filled with rage and anger. Before, these feelings nearly destroyed me. But I've understood there are other ways to fight against injustice, and that's why I'm studying hard to go to university and become a lawyer.
While the word lucky seems inappropriate in Hebom's case, he is fortunate for having received help early on. But centers like this one are only able to serve a few dozen children like him. Hundreds more juveniles are facing their traumas alone. For the World Vision Report, I'm Doreen Jones in Diyarbakir.
Back in Egypt now, where for years under the Mubarak regime, musicians and writers were forced to censor themselves or be harassed by the secret police. Now, for all artists, it's a new day. Bonnie Allen reports from Cairo.
Now here. They tortured us, they killed us, they imprisoned us, they cuffed us.
In a southern suburb of Cairo, inside a new recording studio that still smells of fresh paint, Egyptian rap artist Karim Adel sits in a black leather chair and translates the Arabic lyrics for his song, Rebel.
This is my country and your country, my money and your money. So we both have to revolt against the slavery of you and I.
A call to revolt. It's something Adel wouldn't have dared to sing about in the months leading up to the revolution. Adel and his rap group, Arabian Nights, had refrained from singing about political oppression or corruption in the past because they had to submit their lyrics to the government for approval before selling an album commercially. A previous attempt to bypass that triggered a threatening phone call. Arabian Nights suspects it was Egypt's secret police.
The call just said that we heard your song, watch your back, we have our eyes on you. Click. So yeah, we were threatened actually about some of our music before.
In the midst of the revolution, as Adel camped out in Tahrir Square, his anger gave him courage to write new lyrics. He even uploaded a song on YouTube.
The cops were being ruthless. Some people a couple of meters away from me were getting shot dead. They were dropping dead on the floor, like shot in the head. Even the rubber bullets, they were aiming at the eyes, which can kill you. And we felt that the people needed an anthem. People needed something that they can give them more energy when they're out there.
It's a rough mix that took liberty sampling American artist Lauryn Hill, but indeed it became an anthem for the revolution. Across the city, in an apartment near the Giza pyramids, another musician, Hatem Izzet, feels emboldened by the fall of the Mubarak government. He plucks at a wooden oud, a guitar-like instrument. This song describes poor Egyptian workers making clothes and shoes for rich men, but having none of their own to wear. Beside him sits Mohamed Zinati, a songwriter, playwright, and poet. Zinati admits that he's been censoring his own writing for 2 decades because he knew the government's Department of Culture would never give a stamp of approval to take on sensitive topics. Political corruption, police brutality, religion.
We feel always we are in prison. Yeah, before I write, I am thinking about the government, about what they will accept and what they will have refused. When you think, no, maybe they will refuse this word, so I must change it. And after, when I'll begin in another sentence, oh no, it's not possible, I must change this word also, so...
Officially, the Egyptian constitution protects freedom of speech and expression, but songwriters, filmmakers, and authors have complained about repression for decades. Zinati wrote this song during the protests, and his friend Hatem Izzet composed the music. On this night, they've assembled a group called Voices of Egypt to perform. Izzet's daughter, 13-year-old Habiba, belts out the melody.
عنواني ميدان التحرير
Habiba sits down to speak with me in her bedroom, its pink walls covered in posters of princesses. There are dolls piled in the corner. The young singer believes her voice must be heard too.
I want to make something that's useful for the future because I love Egypt. I want to explain the hope for life in the future and what happened before and what's still to come.
Zunati, who sat enraptured as Habiba performed his new song, can barely contain his excitement. His glasses slide down his nose as he waves his hands in the air.
I think I am free completely. I can write what I mean. I think now I can fly if I want.
Back at the Universal Legends studio, where Arabian Nights performs, construction workers finish soundproofing a new recording booth.
We need to start working on more collaborations because...
And Nights singer, Karim Adel, talks to his manager, Yusuf Salahuddin, about releasing new songs quickly.
Talking more about, like, revolution, more about, like, we our new generation, what we want to do about our country and the Arab country, and we need to, like... This is the right time to do, like... To get our songs and our ideas and our thoughts out, not just keeping inside.
Exactly.
Under military rule, Egypt's future is still uncertain. But Arabian Nights just recorded a controversial song about sexual harassment called Sisters and is working on a song about voting.
I think I can write two more albums right now on what I wanted to say and I couldn't say before.
With that, Adel begins to rap about oppression in the Arab world.
I'm destroying the oppressors in Arabic settlements. I'm known for blowing up beats and governments.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Cairo, Egypt.
It's easy to speak when you're far from the heat. To the White House I creep and yes, I'm armed to the teeth with a mic and a pen and a pad.
Well, it's nearly tax time, and soon you'll be counting up all those donations you made over the last year.
Yeah, and it's definitely not my favorite time of year. It's also so confusing these days. You make contributions in so many different ways. You can text, you can click on a button on a website.
Indeed. Well, we're going to hear more about what's buzzing in the world of philanthropy next on the World Vision Report. Todo ese repertorio me produce orgullo. Y si somos tantos, porque estamos tan al cucho. Bueno, dejemos ese punto a un lado. Hay gente trabajando, pero son contados. Allá rastrillan, hablan jerguiao. Te preguntas si no has jangueado, si estás quedado. Si lo has copiado, lo has vacilado. Si dejaste el que está malo o te lo has rumbiado. Hay mucha calentura en Buenaventura. Y si sos chocuano, sos arrecho por cultura. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder.
And I'm Beverly Abel. Rachel, if I say the name Angelina Jolie, what do you think of?
Lips.
That's not exactly what I had in mind, Rachel. I was thinking more along the lines of her charitable work.
Yeah, okay, that too.
In the last few years, celebrity philanthropy has been all the rage. But it turns out that in philanthropy, just like in everything else, fads come and go.
So what do you think the next philanthropic fad is going to be?
Well, if anyone can tell us, Lucy Bernholtz can. She's been tracking these trends for years. And recently she compiled a list of the hottest buzzwords in philanthropy. She spoke with the World Vision Report's Melinda Penkava.
Lucy Bernholtz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Buzzwords are usually here today, gone tomorrow. But Lucy, you've gathered a list of the top 10 philanthropy buzzwords from the past decade that had staying power. Well, let's look at some of the words that made your list, starting out with number 10, donate now.
So, you know, if you think back just till 1999, we were still getting most of our requests for giving in the mail, writing out checks. But the Donate Now button, which is now seems to be ubiquitous, really changed the landscape for nonprofits and for donors because it's really your one click away. And in just the last decade, we've seen online giving go from pretty much zero to billions of dollars every year. Whether or not it's actually increased the overall amount of giving, unfortunately, we don't know that, but it certainly made it easier for folks.
Another buzzword that you write about here brings up images of Angelina Jolie and others, celebvocates.
Yeah, celebvocates. Going back most of the 20th century, there have been very active celebrity hosts trying to do good and use their name to help draw attention. But it seemed to have tipped in the last decade, where now as part of your celebrity marketing plan, you have to have some kind of cause. And there's just been a sort of a mad rush from both sides, from the celebrities to be affiliated with a good cause and from the causes to be affiliated with a celebrity.
Now, there's a term you have here, embedded giving. and you call this a term of art.
Yeah, because those who are behind it call it cause marketing. So this is the kind of thing that almost most defines the last decade, which is this kind of creeping change that, until you stop and really look back, you don't see how pervasive this has become. Embedded giving is the art of putting into almost every financial transaction some small kind of gift. So when you add a dollar to your checkout bill at the grocery store, or even buy a certain sweater instead of another sweater because it promises that a certain amount of the money will go to a charity. This has been sneaking up on us. If each and every one of us stops and thinks, probably a very good chance that in the last couple of weeks you've been offered the opportunity to give this way. But it's unregulated, it's uncounted, it's hard to know where that money is going. The area has had its fair share of scandals. And the thing that actually does concern me about this is, if you make giving so easy that you don't have to think about it, once we stop thinking about giving, are we going to stop giving?
Or would we be giving smaller amounts, a dollar at the grocery store, as opposed to writing a check at the end of the year?
Exactly. And that's already been shown to have been some of the fallout from the big mobile giving campaign after the earthquake in Haiti last year. It was so easy to give $5 by text message or $10 by text message that lots of people gave $5 or $10 by text message, where they may have actually given more had they taken the time to go home and either log in and do giving online or write out a check.
Well, Lucy Bernholtz, there's another term here on your list, impact investing. Tell us how that works.
So impact investing is one of the most exciting changes, and it actually does have some legs, I think. This is an evolutionary change from socially responsible investing, which is a long-term, long-standing type of financial investment. You're talking about pension funds and people's retirement money, where they're looking to take those dollars and put them to work for social good. So they're looking for a very active kind of investing strategy in which they can place 25, 50,000 up to millions of dollars into clean tech, into solar power, into companies that help bring clean water and irrigation to the poor in various parts of the world, where the money is really, it's not philanthropic. There is a return on the financial investment, a financial return, but there's also a very important social return. And impact investing stands the possibility of being the first innovation in the philanthropic space that will actually explode the number of dollars available for social good.
Well, let's talk about the number one buzzword on your list for the past decade. That is social entrepreneurship. Tell us about that word.
This is a great phrase. First of all, you know it has lasting power when, in fact, it's about a 30-year-old phrase that was first coined, I believe, by Bill Drayton of Ashoka. Over the last decade, since the turn of the century, it seems like everybody wants to be a social entrepreneur. There's now dozens of big fellowship programs. MBA programs are focusing on social entrepreneurship. There's global conferences on social entrepreneurship. There are TV shows about it. And I think it represents a sea change going forward, because people are really looking at their work careers ahead of them and saying, how can I integrate my goals financially and my goals for the world? And there are systems now being built to support that kind of vision.
Can you give us the nuts and bolts of how that works?
You know, the distribution of medicine in various parts of Africa is as much a transportation problem as it is a health problem. So what we really need are some innovative ways to think about moving medicines to the most isolated places. And maybe motorcycles are a better way than trucks. And until we can start working on the larger embedded issues of infrastructure and roads, we're going to create this motorcycle corps that's going to help distribute medicine. And that's actually started from, you know, a very small base of a few people, and it has just expanded really rapidly to the point where that particular example, they're now delivering medicines by motorcycle all over various places in Africa, but they're also now very engaged on the more scalable, systematic level of dealing with infrastructure building in the various African countries where they're working. So what would have been phrased as a health problem now gets shifted into recognizing its connection to these infrastructure issues.
What does this all say about the state of philanthropy today?
Well, it's a very different beast than it was a decade ago. It's much more market-based. There's many more players in the playing field. And I think what it says is, if we stop and reflect, you know, as false as these 10-year markers are, it's sort of extraordinary how significantly the space has changed in just a decade, which leads me to say, you know, what's ahead in the next 10 years? How different will this look in 2020?
Lucy Bernholtz, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Lucy Bernholtz is a philanthropy analyst and founder of Blueprint Research and Design in San Francisco.
Well, Bev, clearly your accent gives you away as an intrepid traveler.
It's not really that obvious, is it, Rachel? Actually, travel is my favorite thing.
Great. Well, I've got your next destination for you. It's got a little bit of a dark history, but it's a remote island in the Philippines called Culion, and it was once the world's largest leper colony. At its peak, there were 16,000 patients.
You know, Rachel, this isn't exactly enticing me right now.
I know. But just listen. The island's turned itself around thanks in part to this entrepreneurial pastor. Culion, once called the land of the living dead, has undergone a remarkable transformation, Bev. Mary Stuckey takes us on a little tour.
As our outrigger boat approaches Culion Island, the vista is breathtaking. Jade-colored hills plunge into blue-green water. But on the steep slope above the wharf is an ominous sign. White stones placed in the shape of a huge eagle. That symbol was constructed almost 100 years ago and is a sign of disease on the island.
When they reach the wharf, most of them don't want to get off the boat. Some even jump to the sea.
Longtime Culion resident Nestor Lisboa is talking about the people with leprosy who were brought here, many against their will, and isolated because of their stigmatized disease. Lisboa grew up on Culion, where his father worked for the telephone company. He didn't have leprosy. Some people on the island were healthy. The two groups were strictly separated.
That is very tragical because the attitude of the non-leper that they treat patients have developed a stigma so deep. Because I grew up here, that's why I feel it. The harm that we did to those people.
With that terrible stigma, most people gave up hope of being cured or ever seeing their families again. Hilarion Gia contracted leprosy as a child and was sent to Culion when he was just 8 years old.
I was asking myself, what is this place that I was brought? I already could see some people. And I was really surprised. How come that almost all people are walking or having this kind of appearance, very, very horrible?
Leprosy can cause horrible disfigurement to a person's skin, limbs, and eyes. It's one of the oldest and most feared diseases. While leprosy is not highly contagious, it was historically believed to be so. It was incurable until the 1980s, when the World Health Organization recommended a multi-drug therapy that was effective against the disease. Dr. Arturo Cunanan is considered a local hero for administering these drugs, though it wasn't until 1998 that all of the island's residents were cured.
And I call it a transformation. With the control of leprosy, there's a lot of development both in terms of infrastructures, communications, and also from the, in the minds of the people that I think stigma and discrimination has no more place in the society today.
And with that transformation, the people of Culion are no longer isolated. In fact, they've invited the world to visit them and their island home, which has retained its pristine natural beauty. There's a new eco-hotel, and tourists can enjoy a mountainous landscape with diverse species, from anteaters to sea turtles and parrots. The island's coral reefs harbor 20 species of butterfly fish. There's a beautiful old Spanish fort and church, and even a history museum with all sorts of medical equipment and mementos, including money, since people with leprosy had their own currency. Tourists are enthralled with the island's history and its traditional ways.
Still, I see Culion as still a preserved environment, and the people itself, the old Filipino hospitality costumes are still with them.
I think the history should be something that they can be proud of. The people, they're very nice and humble, but they're very poor.
Local pastor Father Xavier Alpaza wants to change that. He's spearheading the new eco-hotel and teaching a course at the local college on entrepreneurial tourism. His efforts seem to be paying off. The number of visitors to the island more than doubled between 2008 and 2009. Father Xavier thinks tourism can bring economic development to Culion Island.
We don't want to be a place of noisy bars or, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tourists going around. We envision Culion to be more serene, laid back, quiet, secluded. I believe the history of Culion has spoken, and it presents to us a message that Culion is a place for healing.
No one knows that better than Hilarion Guia. After he was cured of leprosy, he became a beloved school teacher on the island, and then Culion's first elected mayor. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey.
Reporter Catherine Jack contributed to this story. And now, to end our show this week, we go to Mexico City, a noisy place most of the time, partly because of musicians standing on the corners of busy intersections, playing music on street organs. You know, the old boxy instruments with a hand crank on the side? The organs were made in Germany over 100 years ago, and today many of them are falling apart. That's where Sylvia Hernandez comes in. She's one of only a few people who can fix the ancient instruments. Our Mexico correspondent, Grant Fuller, has her story.
It's part of life in Mexico City, whether you love it or hate it. The organ grinder, cranking out Mexican classics at ear-splitting volumes and asking for your change. Today there are less than 200 grinders left in Mexico City, but at least one person is on a mission to keep the organs alive.
Hola. Silvia?
Sí.
Hola.
Hola, buenos días. ¿Cómo estamos?
I meet 65-year-old Sylvia Hernandez on a street corner in the rough, working-class neighborhood of Tepito.
Vámonos, es para allá.
She leads me through a maze of back streets until we get to her house, tucked away inside a hidden alley.
This is my block. You know, a lot of people consider it the cathedral of the organ grinders.
We step into Sylvia's workshop, where about a dozen old organs are lined up on the floor, veiled with red dust covers. She starts to crank an organ that clearly needs some work. Sylvia blows on two good reeds and discovers the third one is stopped up. She got her repair skills from her late husband, whose family helped popularize the organ grinding tradition in Mexico City. As a woman, no one thought to teach her, so she learned by watching the men.
They used to say, "You stay in your kitchen, we'll be in the workshop."
But after her husband died in 1986, Sylvia was left alone and broke, without a single peso, she says. So she found her way to Los Angeles and made a good living as a housekeeper for the wealthy, though her heart was still in Mexico. 6 years later, she'd saved enough to come back home and take over the family business.
When I got here, my organs were all covered in mud balls. They were neglected, abandoned, taken apart. So I had to repair them.
To keep the aging organs in good shape, Sylvia squeezes an antique dust blower.
These poor little machines. These days they're already on their last breath.
Silvia is one of just three people in Mexico City who can fix these organs, and the only woman. Her bond with the instruments runs deep, but she's having a hard time convincing anyone in the family to follow in her footsteps.
Me siento mal porque nadie quiere aprender.
I feel bad because nobody wants to learn this. They think it's boring. The first thing they say is, not that music. It's all music for crazy people.
But Silvia says it's still an important piece of nostalgia for a lot of Mexicans who grew up hearing the organ grinders. For 62-year-old Pedro Perez, it's more than just nostalgia. It's how he makes a living. On a quiet street in downtown Mexico City, he leans on his organ and cranks out a tune.
Es como una cadena.
It's like a chain. If parents tell the kids, look, there goes an organ grinder, this, that, and the other, they'll grow up to teach their kids the same way. But if parents don't say anything, we start to lose the tradition because they'll say, what should I tip him for?
As for Silvia, her livelihood depends on those people dropping coins into a hat. She rents out her organs to 7 grinders in exchange for a small portion of their earnings. They might get $10 on a really good day.
No es una gran fortuna.
We don't make a great fortune, but the reward for us is that they keep on playing. It's a source of work for all these families.
And for that, the grinders are thankful. One of them even made up a special song about Doña Silvia and the organ grinders of Tepito. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Mexico City.
And that's it for this week. Don't forget to visit our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can download podcasts, share your favorite stories with friends, read blogs, and you can post your comments. We're always interested in feedback about the show.
Our production team includes Lida Hartman, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Sue Shepherd, Jenny Schmidt, Julie Drizzen, and Chris Baldiger. And sitting in for Peggy Wehmeyer, I'm Beverly Abel.
And I'm Rachel Louise Snyder.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.